Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Join me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Hi, good to have y'all on, and we're excited about this May 24th, 2020 episode. Join us, our guest, in about 20 minutes, coming back for the second time, author and columnist from the Tampa Bay Times, Craig Pittman. The first time we had Craig on, we discussed his wonderful book, Oh Florida. This time, we're going to talk a little more Florida politics, maybe some other issues going on in the Sun State, but that'll be up in a little bit. But until then, we're going to discuss some political issues of the day, and we're going to go back up north, and Catherine, to bring you back in this week, we're going to make you feel at home, because we're going to discuss Michigan again, a state that really, I think, has been more in the news the past few months than it may have been at any time since we started doing the Kudzu Vine. This past week, Donald Trump went to visit a Ford plant. He actually wore a mask for a period of time, didn't want to seemingly get photographed in it, and then spoke without it, some strange way of having it both ways. He was threatened for not being able to come back or be able to come. Attorney General of Florida. Then he made more comments against the governor there. And the people asked the question, is Donald Trump trying to purposely lose Michigan? Catherine, first, what do you think? And then why, based on what you think?
Well, I just want to say that he was in my home county, in Washtenaw County, and one of the county commissioners said he wasn't welcome back after he was there. He wasn't in my hometown, but he was very close by. I don't think he's intentionally trying to lose Michigan, but I think the behavior that he's doing is making him look like he's intentionally. I think he thinks he's doing everything right. I mean, that's the you know, befuddling thing about this president is that he does everything wrong, but he thinks he's right. They're not happy with him in Michigan. Now, there's a lot of people that are unhappy with the governor as well, but I don't think the pro-Trump people outweigh the pro Whitmer people, at least from what I see from the, you know, I don't really follow the news there, but I don't know. I think he's just, he being the president is, he just doesn't know what to do. He doesn't have any clear idea of what the best thing to do is, or he thinks he does, but he's wrong. And so he just keeps doing the wrong thing. President Ford was not happy either. He made a comment. Something like, well, those are the rules. But, you know, he didn't really criticize him, but he also didn't defend him.
Yeah, you're talking about Gretchen Whitmer. I think she's definitely, you know, kind of the punching bag for the people that really don't like her or want to reopen. But then there was some type of approval rating, Paul, and it was approval rating, approval on handling coronavirus, favorability, but it was like a 70% positive number. So by and large, the people of Michigan approve of what she's doing, even though that other 30 or a portion of that 30 are very vocal against her. But, you know, that's kind of the divide in a lot of these states. The people that dislike whoever the governor is pretty vehement, and they make these visuals that look one way, but then when the, you know, the boring old polls come out, it shows that the people are, you know, not in their corner, if you will. Well, Tim, let's talk about the political side of this. Not even having to go to Michigan or lived in Michigan or visited Michigan, you know how important Michigan was to Donald Trump's 2016 victory. Can he afford to lose it?
Well, no. He won it in 2016 by the grand total of 0.23% You know, a quarter of 1%. He 10,704 votes out of millions. You know, he doesn't exactly have a lot of wiggle room here. The thing's simple. From 2012 to 2016, we talked about this before, African American turnout in Michigan dropped by like 12%. That's why Clinton lost the state, barely. Trump, in the meantime, got overvotes out of those little rural counties, and they added up to just enough to overcome places like Detroit and give the state to Trump. He's doing some odd things here. He's attacking a popular governor. He's accusing the Secretary of State, Benson, of illegally promoting mail-in ballots. Well, it's legal, and other states, including this one, are doing it. And he's screaming, you know, it's voter fraud. Nonsense. All the state's leaders, also, here's an interesting thing, are women. And attacking women. Biden leads among female voters by like 26 points right now in that state. You know, that's 16 electoral votes we'll gladly take because he seems to be intent on giving them away. I don't know what his deal was the other day. The only thing I did understand, guys, was that he visited there. It's a state like Pennsylvania and Arizona, which he has both also visited, that he won barely in 2016, and the polls show him behind in those states now. The latest polling shows Biden ahead in Michigan, and clearly ahead too. There's no in the margin of error stuff here. He is clearly ahead right now in Michigan, running like 5.5 points ahead in real clear politics, and that's a pretty good lead.
Yeah, there's been a lot of polling out of the state. I think I've sent you some of it. There was one poll, and I forget the service, that was kind of margin of error, but the rest of them were high single digits. There was also a poll, I think, or two that showed Gary Peters is in a much safer position than he seemingly was like 5 or 6 months ago. It looks like clearly Michigan has moved to the left. It's become more in the Democratic column than certainly it was in 2016, if not even in, say, January. So it's become a real problem source. Now, because it's moved so, you know, seemingly more safely in the Democratic column, although you certainly can't count your votes until they're cast, if you will, but at one point, Gretchen Whitmer was on the short list for VP. I'm sure she's still on. Actually, I don't know how the short list is. It may still have, you know, double-digit names for all we know. But she was on that list. Catherine, the safer Michigan becomes, does it hurt her prospects of possibly being the VP selection?
Well, I can't imagine that she would be the VP selection. I think it would be a big error. She's a strong governor. She's got at least, you know, 2 more years to be governor, right? And extend another term. So I think it would be a mistake to pull her out as governor to run as VP. There's plenty of other candidates that are as strong or stronger. And I think now that Michigan is getting stronger in the Biden camp anyway, seems like it would be a terrible loss to the state to remove their governor.
Well, I do know that one thing is David Neer was on the show the other week. He made clear that you really have to have somebody that's kind of ready day one. And so even though you might say, oh, well, you know, we have this red state and this purple state and this blue state, at the end of the day, you have to pick somebody that's ready. And, you know, somebody with executive experience, and there are other people, would be, to me, pretty attractive to run, you know, as the VP with a 77-year-old, and having that leadership. Because like we've talked about, for all of Joe Biden's experience, he's never been the head executive. He's always been the senator or the number two. So, you know, I would think a head executive would be attractive to add to that somewhere. Tim, your thoughts. Do you think this affects or hurts her chances if Michigan becomes, you know, clear in the Democratic column?
It probably hurts her chances. I'm with Catherine. I don't think there's any way she's going to get picked. As a matter of fact, I think there's a white female from up in that part of the country. It's going to be Amy Klobuchar. But I don't think it would be her. It would be great to have a governor on the ticket that would check one of the balance boxes, but she doesn't check enough of the boxes. And right now, outside of, you know, the political people, how many people know who she is?
Yeah, that's the other thing.
I don't. If he's already ahead in Michigan, beyond the margin of error, there are bigger fish to fry in other places, you know, like Florida and some of them. So, I mean, if we're looking at somebody to help us take a state, we're not going to be looking to Michigan, I don't think. I think we would be looking to Florida or, you know, North Carolina, you know, some other state, but somebody from Ohio or something like that, but not Michigan. Matter of fact, I believe we could do as well with an African-American female on the ticket among the Michigan voters that we need to get out there, especially those folks in Detroit, to vote heavily. We could do just as well with, you know, with that angle as we could with the very governor of the state up there right now.
Maybe better.
Yeah, well, I'll say this.
Mm-hmm.
Is I think the key rating as far as, you know, knowing the person, you have the chance to get introduced to him. I don't think Mike Pence was a household name, and I sure know the former mayor of Wasilla, Alaska, nobody had heard of. And she seems to be the thought leader
things.
Of the Republican Party over the past
it
decade.
Was two different things, David. For one thing, Trump wanted somebody like Pence that was basically a lamppost, because Trump wanted to take up all the oxygen in the room, and he wanted to be the guy, and he just wanted Pence to be another member of his staff, basically.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what he got. And he even chose a guy from a safe state. So, you know, he didn't choose a guy to help him. He just chose somebody that wouldn't hurt him and wouldn't take up any news headlines, because he wanted them all. And, you know, as it turned out, he was right.
Yeah.
And John McCain, he threw a Hail Mary pass in 08. He had to, and unfortunately, he ended up having that pass dropped. But, you know, it was just something wild to try. Biden's got a little bit different
thing to look for this time. So,
well, I mean, I don't think she'll necessarily, and I think as Michigan, you know, if the polling continues to say like it is, that will hurt chances. But I think she's probably one of the more well-known governors out of this coronavirus. You know, Andrew Cuomo's probably number one, and then maybe a Brian Kemp for the wrong reasons, or Ron DeSantis, they may be up high too. But I think she's one of the higher known ones out of this, so I think that helps her. But then, you know, Harry Truman, little-known senator from Missouri, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt tapped him. But, Tim, you brought up Minnesota. You brought up Amy Klobuchar. So let's talk about that now. I know we had kind of had it as a backup. It just seems to fit right now. Amy Klobuchar, of course, she keeps getting mentioned. But I saw more than one place, and it seems to be more like Democratic-leaning people, they're bringing up the way she treats her staff. I mean, I saw it in a tweet. It was tweeted by one of our former – retweeted by one of our former guests about, we don't want somebody that throws office supplies at their staff. Now, I will say this. I think they should talk to a lot of her staff for the presidential campaign, and if she treated that staff – very calmly and professionally throughout that high-stress campaign, there's a chance she's changed. And you know, that should be important to figure in on this. But there's going to be more calculations in it. Catherine, what are you hearing and reading about the chances of Amy Klobuchar?
I think Klobuchar would be a huge mistake. I get that it's, you know, Minnesota and – we really want to – I think both Minnesota and Wisconsin, she plays well there, and maybe even some other parts of the Midwest. But I just – well, there's two things. I like her as a senator, and I just don't think she has the kind of charisma that we need to balance Joe Biden. I mean, I like her. I don't dislike her. And the way she treats staff, I think that's been discussed a lot. I think they have talked to a lot of her staff members and have not found a, you know, huge number of examples of this misbehavior. So I don't think that's as, I think that's a little bit of a, just sort of an excuse. People don't like her, so they use that as an excuse. But I just don't think she would be a good balance for the ticket, in my opinion.
Tim, your thoughts on Amy Klobuchar?
Well, I'm pretty sure she's on the short list. Biden's people were very impressed with her overperformance, actually, during the primary season. Another very important item is that Joe Biden personally likes her and she personally likes him, and that goes a long way.
Yeah,
sometimes in determining the pick. I know if I recall right, Hillary Clinton only won Minnesota by, like, I don't know, a point and a half, like, I don't know, 45,000 votes, something like that. It was close, and no Republican has carried Minnesota, of course, since Nixon in 72. And Trump would very much like to go get it, and Amy Klobuchar could take that off the table. But you know, those states tend to block vote up there. The trends don't seem to stop at state lines up there sometimes. It seems like the way Michigan goes, well, Wisconsin and to a lesser extent, Minnesota will go that way too. I've got to believe if Joe Biden on election night wins Michigan, then there's no worries at all about Minnesota, and I believe he will win Wisconsin as well. That's just the way those three states go. So the fact that Joe Biden is doing well in Michigan might disqualify her about as much as it would Governor Whitmer. I think still she is on the short list. I wouldn't be overly surprised if he picked her, but I believe there's probably a couple of people above her on the list.
Yeah, I'll tell you, she's probably not the top of my list. I will say this. One of the more intriguing things, if she were picked, to me would be if she got picked, a scenario where Kristen Gillibrand could call for it, you know, just as – I mean, it's not her decision to make, obviously, but if she could somehow say it's time for Al Franken to return to the Senate to fill that seat, I think it would kind of help remake her image a little bit too. But then return Al Franken to the Senate, which I think a lot of Democrats would like to see, but that's just some kind of, you know, third thing down reason, and that's not the reason Joe Biden's picking something. It needs to be who can be ready to fill in for vice president from you know, day one if necessary. Well, we want to go ahead and welcome our guest in for the second time to the Kudzu Vine from the Tampa Bay Times and an author in his own right. Welcome back to the show, Craig Pittman.
Thank you very much. I'm not with the Times anymore. They laid me off in March, but I'm now a columnist for the Florida Phoenix, so I'm still in their pitching.
I apologize for that. Since you were there so long, so many of your sources and the book jacket covers and everything still listed.
I understand.
Yeah,
came as a shock to me, too.
Well, I've heard about the cutbacks that papers suffered. They've cut back just on their publications and whatnot.
Yeah.
Well, Craig, last time we had you on, we discussed that phenomenal book, Oh Florida, because you're a lifelong Floridian, which is not apparently the most common species down there. So we thought, well, let's have you back and talk some Florida politics.
Sure.
For starters, if you will. But I want to talk about something different than politics before I talk about politics, and then Catherine and Tim have other questions. And because it's May, it's creeping right at Labor Day. I'm sorry, Memorial Day, and it's getting that time where people normally would think about going to vacation, and a lot of people going down to Florida for vacation. But now it's appearing that there'll still be some people going vacation, but not the numbers Florida's used to. What are y'all anticipating, and how's that going to affect your economy?
It's bad. I mean, you know, the Florida's been trying to draw tourists since the 1880s. Harriet Beecher Stowe actually started our tourism industry. Believe it or not, she moved here after the Civil War and fell in love with Florida and wrote stories in the northern papers encouraging people to come visit, and they did. And it's just kind of built from there. And you know, in the last several decades, that's been our biggest industry. It's actually surpassed agriculture and construction and everything else. And you know, now with the people, you know, everybody doing the stay at home thing, it's really hurt the hotels, the casinos, the theme parks had to shut down. You know, Disney's anticipating a $1 billion loss. I actually for a story I'm writing, I actually called up a number of our nudist resorts. We have the largest number of nudist resorts in the country here in Florida, and they're hurting too, because you know, they usually springtime is their big money time when they have lots and lots of people who want to be naked who drive down in their RVs and so forth and come down here and stay. And you know, those folks, they stayed home, and so it's, you know, those folks, they don't wear clothes, but they have a lot of money, even though they don't have pockets, you know. so they're missing out on those tourist dollars too. So, you know, it's we have to laugh about this stuff, because otherwise you cry. I mean, one guy said, normally when we greet people at the nudist resort, where there's a lot of hugging and kissing, and instead we're asking people just to do a butt bump, because we think that's more sanitary.
Goodness. Well, we'll keep our clothes on for the next tourism question or two. But I know that I've been to vacation in several parts of Florida, and I mean, if people haven't been to Florida, not only are the parts of the state different, but people tour in different parts of states for different reasons, or they come from different backgrounds, if you will. If you go more to the Panhandle area, you may be a little more southern, not as looking for as much maybe cultural sophistication. If you go to, say, the Tampa-St. Pete area, that area maybe gets some even European travelers, because I've been to the grocery store,
sure.
Publix down there. They have sections.
Dunedin area gets a lot of Canadians, because that's where the Toronto Blue Jays do their spring training. So they get a lot of Canadians there.
Yeah. Yes, and so my question is, are there different parts of the state that are anticipating doing better because of their local vacation niche or clientele?
I think anybody that's, I expect the Panhandle to do better, because I think they draw a lot of their tourists from around the South. I think there's going to be a drop in international tourism just because people are hesitant to leave home, number one. But number two, because, you know, the economic consequences of all this have been pretty dire. And, I'm not sure people are going to want to take time off to travel to another country right now. But if you're counting on people coming from nearby, I think that's going to work. And in fact, I believe that's going to be the focus of some Visit Florida, which is our state tourism agency. I think that's going to be the focus of some of their advertising, is encouraging people to visit their local tourist attractions to try and get, you know, Florida residents to at least kind of do something to help prop up the tourism economy. The other thing too is, there are some things you can do on vacation that still fit with social distancing, like hiking nature trails, things like that. And Florida's got this award-winning state park system. It's won 4 national awards, which is more than any other state park system in the country. And so if you go, you know, you can go swim in a spring, you can go visit a world-famous beach or something like that, and still maintain that 6-foot distance from the other tourists, then you're probably you're probably doing pretty good. And generally that's cheaper than going to one of the theme parks as well.
Yes. Well, we've got so much more to cover about bathrooming, if you will, while you're in touring and staying places, because they say that's going to be a big inhibitor, but we promise to keep our clothes on. Because if you look at 2018 around the country, it made so much sense. You know, for places like North Dakota and Indiana, where Democratic senators lost, and there were so many pickups in the House where Democrats won in urban areas and suburban areas. And so while Democrats by and large did better, where the Republicans' gains were made a lot of sense, except for one race. And that was incumbent Bill Nelson in Florida, had been serving since the 90s, had always won re-election. He lost in a Democratic wave year in a state that is, you know, seemingly a swing state that kind of follows the political trends. What happened?
I'd say two things happened. One is Bill Nelson ran a very old-fashioned campaign that didn't fit the modern times. You know, he would get up and make speeches on the floor of Congress, figuring that would get him news coverage. And, you know, it's like, no, you need to be running ads, because we've got 10 different media markets in Florida, and so you got to run ads in just about every one of them, which means raising an awful lot of money for your campaign. His opponent, Governor Rick Scott, a millionaire in his own right, paid for an awful lot of ads, and it made the difference. The other thing, too, is that you have to bear in mind that Florida is pretty evenly split as far as the number of voters in each party. And you've got to so that's why most of our elections, our statewide elections, wind up in recounts. There's just that razor-thin margin between victory and defeat. If I remember right, Scott's margin of victory was about 1%. So if Nelson had gotten out and really worked to, say, get the Latino vote out, that would have made a difference, because we had this tremendous influx of people from Puerto Rico who were fleeing the destruction from Hurricane Maria, and they have made a huge difference in the population in Central Florida. There was a concerted effort by the Democratic Party and the Republican Party to register those folks to vote and in Florida, and I don't think Nelson did anything at all, if I remember right, to appeal to those voters to try and get them to come out for him. You know, it's not a presidential election year, so you're going to have – the turnout's going to be a little lower than it would be in a presidential election year. So if you're running, you got to do something to get people to turn out. And, of course, a lot of the folks in diehard Republican areas, like in the Villages, our major retirement community, they came out. I mean, they got encouraged to come out, and they all hopped in their golf carts and headed for the polls. And I'm not sure there was a similar effort by Nelson to do the same.
Yes. Kind of sounds like, to kind of use a Florida analogy, it'd be like trying to win a football game in 2020 with Don Shula's 1970 playbook. It was incredible back then, but times have moved on. Lawton Childs and Bob Graham were incredible politicians, couldn't use their playbook today.
No, definitely not. And now, and I don't know if y'all heard this, but just today there was a ruling by a judge that could upend the whole apple cart, where he ruled specifically that the constitutional amendment that passed by a wide majority saying ex-felons should be given back the right to vote, he ruled that the state cannot require them to pay their outstanding fines and fees before they get the right to vote back. So, and that's something that Governor DeSantis has been fighting tooth and nail. He wants them to pay. And the judge said, no, that wasn't part of the vote. And so, you know, the assumption is a lot of those folks are going to wind up voting Democratic. And so we'll see what that does in the fall.
Yes, sir. Good information. Well, I'm going to pass this thing over to Catherine. He'll pass it over to Tim. Catherine?
Okay.
Hey, how you doing tonight? I hope you're...
I am full as a tick. I went to my in-laws
safe.
And ate barbecue. I ate barbecue at my in-laws, so I'm full, yeah. So if I sound satisfied, that's why.
I understand that there's a – you had mentioned in your exchange with David this thing about the Florida Panthers and some developers and DeSantis. Could you give us a little more information about that?
Yeah. Last year, the Senate president, a guy named Bill Galvano, who's a lawyer in Bradenton, he met with the Florida Association of Road Builders and also with the Florida Chamber, very large campaign contributions, and then announced that he'd come up with this brilliant idea that the legislature was going to sponsor the building of these three major toll roads, and that would create jobs, and it would connect the rural communities with the rest of the state and would help to stimulate development. And the Florida DOT was like, wait, what? Because they didn't have any of these roads on their plans. You know, they make these elaborate five-year plans. None of these roads were on their plans. And it was supposed to be for the benefit of the rural communities, several of which have already voted and said, we don't want them. We don't want to change the way we are. We like being rural. And the probably the most controversial part of it is that one of the roads – would actually cut through what's left of Florida panther habitat. Florida panther is our state animal, and it's an endangered species. And the biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wrote a memo to his bosses that said this will destroy just about all that's left of Florida panther habitat, and I recommend we, you know, go on record opposing this. And, you know, they're still going ahead with public meetings and public hearings in spite of the coronavirus. They're doing them online. And to ask people for where should these roads go and what, you know, how should we build them and are there any particular areas we should avoid? I have to say this is kind of a sidelight, but I have to tell you this part. One of the roads would go from Citrus County straight up to the Georgia line. And so I thought, well, I wonder if anybody told Georgia we're coming. So I called up the Georgia DOT, and they were like, wait, what? You're doing what? Nobody had told them. They were like, that's going to kind of dead end out in the middle of nowhere. I don't know if we really want to do that. So this is what happens when politicians put themselves in charge of planning where roads ought to go. This is kind of the outcome of that. Now, Governor DeSantis, there was a huge opposition to this bill when it passed the legislature. Governor DeSantis signed it, and his justification was people need roads. And that's all he said about it. And that was 2019. Here we are in 2020. These roads are going to cost billions of dollars. And at a time when, you know, because of the coronavirus and the stay-at-home orders, the Florida's toll road system has lost millions and millions of dollars over the last several months. And so now there are questions coming up about, you know, okay, maybe we didn't need these things before, but now we really don't need them, and we probably couldn't pay for them either. So it's all kind of up in the air. But the DOT, you know, they're soldiering on with the thing, so we'll see what happens.
What a crazy story.
Yes. And, you know, and this And it's like, oh, it's, you know, that's like a Tuesday in Florida, you know.
Well, that, I get that, but still. Well, that was really interesting. I'm going to pass it to Tim. Go ahead, Tim.
Okay.
Good evening, Mr. Pittman. Thank you for being on with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Recent polling is showing that Joe Biden actually is leading Donald Trump among senior voters nationally. Now, Florida, as we know, is one of those states that has a larger share of seniors than the national average.
Right.
These seniors in Florida, though, yeah, these seniors traditionally, though, are pretty conservative. Is
right.
there any indication that they might be swinging in any way toward Biden?
I haven't seen it, if it's there, but, you know, we'll see. I know a large number of those folks have been pretty alarmed at what's been happening with the coronavirus pandemic,
mm-hmm.
and it's especially the way it's hit the nursing homes pretty hard. Polls have shown that people are more cautious than the government leaders about getting back out in public and circulating. And so if that mm-hmm. translates into them not necessarily liking or trusting what they're being told by the government, they may be inclined to vote against what the government folks say they should do. You know, it may influence
mm-hmm.
their decision in the presidential race. On the other hand, so much of that is personality driven and driven by what people see on TV ads that at this point,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're still several months out. It's kind of hard to predict one way or the other. But
well,
in general, I'd say, you know, just kind of wait and see.
As for the pandemic itself, now, Florida is a very unique state with its tourism and with its
right.
population mix. Is the pandemic viewed by the residents of Florida as more of a health issue or as more of an economic issue?
I'd say largely health issue, but it's a big economic issue, too, because part of the problem with basing your economy on tourism is that means you have an awful lot of people who are part of the service economy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when bars and restaurants shut down and hotels shut down, that means those folks, they're out of work. And that's why
mm-hmm.
Florida's unemployment claims have climbed to a point beyond they even had during the Depression. And it would
mm-hmm.
it put so much pressure on our unemployment compensation system that the whole computer system crashed. I mean, just
mm-hmm.
just flat out crashed. And so there's been this growing discontent among the people who have been battling that system, trying to get unemployment money. That it's really become a backlash against the DeSantis administration, that he's been unable to get that fixed yet. And
mm-hmm.
He has, how can I put this? He has, instead of expressing sympathy for the people who are in that bind, he has blamed the people applying for benefits and said it's their fault that they haven't been able to get the system to work. And so that may not work out too well for him in the long run because, hey, you know, a lot of those folks, they do vote. You know,
uh-huh.
if you make them mad, they're liable to go to the polls.
You know, Donald Trump earlier made a big, very big deal out of renouncing his citizenship of the state of New York and saying
yep.
he is now a resident of Florida. Do the people of Florida view Donald Trump as a fellow Floridian?
Well, you know, he has had a residence here for quite a number of years. I'm trying to remember the
mm-hmm.
date when he bought Mar-a-Lago, but it's been quite a while ago. I want to say it was in the 90s or the early 2000s. So he's had a
mm-hmm.
part-time residence here for quite a while. And, you know, Floridians have learned not to look down their noses at people coming in from outside because two-thirds of the people who live here are from somewhere else, which is that's a
mm-hmm.
higher percentage than any other state except Nevada. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, he's on the side of the state that gets a lot of people from New York. So the way
mm-hmm.
he behaves is like
yeah.
a lot of people from New York who moved to Florida. You know,
yeah.
they're kind of used yeah. to that. So, you know, the people who are accepting of him are people who I think like his politics, and obviously there are quite a few people who feel that way. And the people who don't
mm-hmm.
like him calling himself a Florida man, well, they're the ones who are not happy with his politics. And like I said, Florida is split pretty much down the middle politically. I mean, we're not a red state. We're not a blue state. We're a purple state. You know.
Yeah. Now, as far as handling that split, Val Demings has indicated that she's being vetted by the Biden campaign for the vice presidential nomination. Would her presence on the ticket be enough to swing Florida toward Biden in any significant way?
That's a good way to put it. I think she would bring him a tremendous number of black votes, but I think he would get those anyway. I think what would happen, though, is you might see a bigger turnout in the minority community if she was on the ballot for him. And she does bring some pretty impressive credentials. I mean, she was Orlando's first black police chief, so she's got a real strong law and order background. I don't know if she's got the sort of national profile that he would want necessarily, though, like Kamala Harris or Stacey Abrams, just to pick a couple of other examples. You know, although she was one of the House impeachment managers, I don't think that raised her profile quite enough. But she'd be an interesting pick, and this choice has even more importance than it normally would have, because Biden has said, you know, I'm probably not going to run a second term. Probably whoever is going to be my VP, you know, that's who's going to run for president next. So I guess the question you have to ask yourself is, has she had enough seasoning nationally that she would know what to do if she ran for president herself? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that at this point. But I mean, she would be an interesting choice. That's for sure.
I want to ask you about one more Florida politician, then I'm going to send it back to David.
Okay.
Of course, we all saw what happened to Mayor Gillum earlier this year. And if I'm not mistaken, he is maybe, I believe, is about the age he is. Is he finished in Florida politics?
Oh, good Lord, no. I mean, you know, we've had so many politicians mess up and then run for re-election. No, definitely not. I mean, we had a guy in Miami who ran for re-election and won while he was under indictment. So, you know, we laugh about it, but here's the thing is, every day we get about 900 people moving into Florida, and those people are new voters. They have no idea the background of anybody who's running when the elections roll around. They don't have any context. They don't remember what the problems were 4 years ago that everybody promised to fix and didn't. So they're making their decisions based on what Charlie, who lives next door, recommends, and the fellas they know at the Lions Club, and then whatever they see, whatever TV ads they see. So, you know, that's why we end up with a lot of politicians we end up with. Let me just put it that way. Is it the voters are brand new? And they don't know what's happened in the past, and frankly, a lot of them are still tied in mentally to what's happening in their home states, rather than what's going on in Florida.
Oh.
So that's both the blessing and the curse of having so many new people moving in. You know, is that they may not be the most well-informed voters in the world.
Well, I've never heard it quite put that way, but that's fascinating to hear.
With that,
I'm going to send it right back to David. David?
Yes. Well, one final question. It's a little bit political, but a little bit sports related, too. And that would be, seemingly, when anybody talks about getting their league restarted, they mention Florida. And I think Ron DeSantis has been kind of promoting this. And actually, pro wrestling, they have no fans, but the hub of pro wrestling for the world right now is in Florida with the two
and
big
the
promotions
talking about starting,
you know, broadcasting weekly.
The NBA is talking about starting here, too. And Tiger Woods is doing a charity golf match today here in Florida, too. So,
Heard MLS, mate, if they come back, they're going to come back in Orlando, the latest thing I've heard. American Soccer League. So how do Floridians view that? Are they excited, or is that kind of like, why are we bringing all these other people in, or what's their thought?
I think they're excited about it because, I mean, Florida is definitely a pro sports state, and, you know, and anything that helps to stimulate the economy and get things moving again, I think they're in favor of it. And I think the other thing, too, is people think, well, if you get a little taste of Florida, you're liable to get hooked on it. And so maybe it'll lead to, in the long run, more and more stuff being being played here and being put on here and, you know, and that kind of thing. So, you know, it's just it to be honest, just sort of in a long-term sense, what's happened with all the shutdowns and everything, I think has made people appreciate what makes Florida special so much, which is, you know, the beautiful weather we've had all spring, the beautiful beaches that we're finally getting to go back out on, and the fact that we can deal with all of this influx of, you know, of sports type stuff. So, you know, it's I think they're very happy about it, honestly.
Yeah, well, and obviously this is a short-term thing. It's kind of
sure.
like Florida would be the Hollywood of sports where you film games without fans.
Right.
Now, you know, 5 years from now, the Buffalo Bills versus the Denver Broncos in Tampa Bay probably wouldn't draw much of a crowd if you had fans. You'd have to have it in Denver.
Probably not. Probably not. I mean, think about it. The big rap on the Tampa Bay Rays and the Florida Marlins is they don't draw fans. Well, if you're not having fans come into the stadium anyway, what difference does it make? <You know>?
Yes, definitely so. Well, I tell you what, I would love to have you on and down the road before this election to talk about, you know, more Florida politics. And we also are going to have to get you on once I've listened to your new book about the Florida Panthers. But in the meantime,
yes. Cattail. A lot of people are calling Cattail a good quarantine
every day. Tell everybody about that book.
Tell everybody
where they can get the book and tell them where they can read
sure.
your writings.
My latest book is Cattail, The Wild, Weird Battle to Save the Florida Panther. It tells about how the Florida Panther got to be the state animal thanks to the state's school children, and then very nearly went extinct and was only kind of hauled back from the brink thanks to an unprecedented scientific experiment. There's some fascinating characters involved, a woman who gave a dying panther mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, which honestly is a commitment to the job you seldom see in America these days, and even the Florida's fabled skunk ape, our version of the Bigfoot, actually makes a little cameo appearance. And it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound. One of our local stores here, Tombolo Books, is selling autographed copies online, so if you want an autographed copy, that's who you contact. It's doing really well. And Oh Florida, the one you mentioned before, that was the one that was a New York Times bestseller. So I'm hoping this one will head that way too.
Yes, well, and I tell you what, given the popularity of Tiger King, and if you get the story, give him mouth resuscitation, maybe you'll have a sequel to that to do a documentary.
Well, it would be worth it. It really would. There's some crazy stuff going on.
Yes. Well, Craig, thanks for coming on the show again.
My pleasure. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right. That was Craig Pittman of the Florida Phoenix and author of so many books. And like if we remember, he was on with O Florida, a lifelong Floridian who really understands and appreciates the history of the Sunshine State. Well, let's kind of continue on our discussion. Didn't get to when we were talking about the discussion is there's just really not a lot of places for Donald Trump to play offense. And I think ever since, say, 2008, Minnesota was mentioned by the McCain campaign as a place where they could play some offense. This would be 8, 12, 16. This would be at least the fourth cycle in a row the RNC Republicans have touted this concept. Catherine, how good a target is Minnesota for the Republicans?
I just don't see it as a good target. You know, it's been a long time since the president won there. It's a, you know, liberal Midwestern state with, you know, really friendly and hardworking people. I just don't see the current, you know, Trump messaging and attitude playing well there.
Yeah. Tim, looking at the same thing with, I think I dropped out. I was like, Catherine, stop talking. Tim, same thought there. Is Minnesota a target?
Well, yeah, I think there's not many places they can target. We're very polarized in this country. But he only lost Minnesota, like I mentioned earlier, by 45,000 votes. It has a very low percentage of minorities. It is a lot of working class folks, especially up in the Duluth area. It is a state, if he's going to try to look to expand the map, I think that's one place he's possibly going to look at. I mean, when you lose a state by a point and a half after you have won an election, you know, why not give it a shot? The other three places I think they may look at are Virginia, New Hampshire, and Nevada. Other than that, I don't really see where Trump could go. And when I mentioned those four states right there, I would rank Nevada, but New Hampshire as his number one target, because I believe Clinton only won it by like 2,700 votes. And then I would rank Minnesota as the number two target. What about you?
Yes, I think they have to try to play offense somewhere. Obviously, when they only won by, you know, a limited number of electoral votes, playing all defense is not a good place to be, so they got to find somewhere. Another thing that makes Minnesota interesting is one of the biggest targets congressionally for the Republicans is that 7th district, which is most of that iron range, includes Duluth, that Colin Peterson holds. I believe it's the district that voted by the largest margin for Donald Trump that supports or has a Democratic congressman. And so if you did push some resources in, particularly to that part of the state, then you're going to help Colin Peterson. I mean, obviously with 400-some-odd districts, you can't target them all, but that's one that would be valuable. Also, there's another district, the third, which was a traditionally Republican seat that Democrats flipped, because it's really interesting. Like when people think about the class of 2018, they think about representatives like Ilhan Omar, who just won Keith Ellison's old Democratic seat. But people that actually kind of flipped the majority makers, were people like Dean Phillips, who really doesn't get as much attention, but is in more of a swing district. So those are two places if you paid some attention to Minnesota, you could help preserve those seats, maybe strengthen them. Maybe they're not even at risk in 2020, but maybe in 2022. I know reapportionment will have to come up, 2024, things like that. And Minnesota is also an interesting state in that the city of Minneapolis and to extent St. Paul were very Democratic. The southern part of the state, which was a little more suburban, pretty well educated, I think, where the Mayo Clinic is, that was more Republican. And then the northern part of the state was a bunch of working class union Democrats. That's the part of the state that's changed. Also, the southern part of the state has become more Democratic, not Democratic, but more Democratic. And then, of course, the northern part of the state is becoming more Republican. It's definitely a state in transition, but it's maybe a state where you reshuffle the cards, but the hand is the same when you get redealt it. Catherine, I mean, what do you think about putting resources in the state, not necessarily just for the electoral votes?
Well, you know, I believe in a 50-state strategy. So I think if there's money available, I mean, we need to raise the money to fight in as many districts as we can. And so holding on to what we've got and trying to flip some others, I think that's a good plan, but it's all dependent on how much money we have.
Yeah. Well, interesting to see. And Tim, go ahead.
I would imagine the Minneapolis St. Paul TV market bleeds over into the area of Wisconsin that Donald Trump really needs to turn out in order to hang on to Wisconsin. So if you play ball in Minnesota, you get two for the price of one. It helps you play offense in a Democratic state, and it helps you to play defense
in an adjoining state that you just desperately have got to hang on to, because Trump just can't afford to lose states like Wisconsin, and I think playing ball in Minnesota, if the map looks pretty close to what we saw 4 years ago, would be really good strategy. So,
yeah, good point. It'll be interesting to see how they handle that, both campaigns, because the map is, you know, I think it was Rick Wilson who said, you know, 35 states, nobody's in play. You got to focus on those 15, and it'll get whittled down to about 5 by the time all is said and done.
Yeah. But
Minnesota's definitely in the 15 at this point, if you will. Well, Tim, you kind of brought up a topic with Craig Pittman that was something else we were going to discuss, and it's that, you know, Joe Biden was not the Democratic choice of young voters, but he put together a coalition that has him on track to be the nominee. But since coronavirus has hit, polling has shown something very interesting, and I don't know if it was Joe Biden's in a good place to capture it or any Democratic nominee, presumptive nominee, was in a good place to capture it. But older voters, and this is not just Florida, it's throughout the country, and I've been fascinating to see if some states more than others this is happening, but older voters are not becoming majority, but moving towards the Democratic column. How big a shift is this, Tim?
Well, especially during this virus, you mentioned that women right now among the above the age of 65, Biden plus 22, men Trump plus 11. Now, independent voters in that age group in February, before this ever hit, Biden had a 7-point lead amongst that group. He now has a 20-point lead. Now, in 2016, this age group, as we know, voted for Trump by 9 points, 53 to 44, and they were over 1/4 of the electorate. These people vote. And there's another thing, favorables amongst this age group. Right now, Biden has 12 points above Walker on his favorables. Clinton, at this same point in the campaign in 2016, was 13 points underwater. Trump has a major, major problem right here. He simply cannot afford to lose this age group, which basically was his most loyal age group. He cannot lose this group and win re-election. He just can't.
Catherine, now we know that older voters are the most likely to turn out. So it's not like Joe Biden's going to necessarily have to have this GOTV strategy to get them to the polls, because they may just go anyway. But what does he have to do to keep them in these numbers in the Democratic column?
Well, he probably needs to figure out a way that he can reach them to talk about healthcare and this crisis, and also make sure that they're aware of their voting options, because we don't know what it's going to be like in November. We could still be in some, you know, shelter at home state, especially for certain people, like elderly people and compromised people. So I think those are two things that he needs to reach them about: how they vote, and, you know, what he's going to do about healthcare, and specifically how he's going to prepare us for this pandemic and future pandemics.
Well, that's a good point, because it's seemingly healthcare has been a major mover. Now, one more thing I want to mention on this and get y'all's thoughts quick. I just finished listening to a book about generational leadership called The Ones Who've Been Waiting For, and it's about millennials, but they mention other generations and they talk about the time frame. And the greatest generation, it obviously had, you know, multiple presidents from it. And the baby boomers have had at least two. I'm not sure where Barack Obama falls in it, but I know Clinton and George W. Bush were both baby boomers. But the silent generation, the people that were born before 1946, and I want to say the first year that was, say, 1931, they've never had a president out of that generation. Michael Dukakis lost, John McCain lost, and there's at least one more I'm forgetting that lost. So that generation's never had a president. Joe Biden, born 1941, would likely be the only person out of that generation should he win the presidency. I guess, who knows, maybe, you know, if he doesn't win, we'll have an 83-year-old nominee in 2024, the way things went this year. But Catherine first, then Tim quickly. Would that be a selling point to maybe a few voters that like certain things about both candidates, knowing that somebody from your generation would become president, be the only person in your age range?
I don't see how – well, first of all, I don't know how you easily talk about that, because not everybody understands how the how the generations are defined, number one. Number two, I'm not sure that it's enough of a characterization that it would – have meaning for enough people to make it worthwhile to try to explain it. Cause I think it would be, you know, you can't do it in one sentence. It's more complicated.
Well, it'd
be
micro-targeting. Yeah. You wouldn't waste your time with baby boomers and Gen X and millennials and IGN. You wouldn't waste your time with all them. It would be micro-targeted towards voters a certain age and older.
Yeah. That's asking a lot of this, Biden campaign. They don't seem to understand
the campaign.
Some of those.
Yeah.
What?
Well,
I mean,
somebody in Democratic politics can figure it out, they're going to have more than just the staff that won the primary. I mean, they can add, you know, people, you know, into the campaign. Mm-hmm. They can add anybody from the Obama campaign, theoretically.
They've got campaign leadership that isn't big on some of the new campaign technology and strategy. So I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I just don't know how you sell it and how you convince them that it's worth it.
Well, you don't sell it by saying I'm from your age group. Joe Biden does not want his age to be an issue for obvious reasons. Secondly, he can appeal to that group. Catherine's already mentioned how, by talking about health care, especially nursing home safety, which is a very important thing for people age 65 and over to hear about, especially during this time of this pandemic and what has happened in these retirement homes.
Yeah. And I think naturally he knows how to talk to the people in that age group a little better. When I saw him on early in all this, one of the main things he talked about, he was so lucky that his grandkids could come over and they could be on the back porch and they could talk to the grandkids, but they couldn't hug them, they couldn't kiss them. And if he talks about that and Donald Trump talks about how much he misses the golf course, I think the average person at that age range is going to really identify more with missing their grandchildren and even great-grandchildren than missing their golf game. So I think he does talk the language a little better without thinking about the generational aspect of this. Well, I want to thank again Craig Pittman for coming on the show, talking to us about Florida. And until next week, it's been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night, y'all.
Good night, guys.
Good night, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.